I now call upon our brother Frank to lead us in the sixth session entitled The Time of Trouble Such as Never Was. Brother Frank.
How am I supposed to do this?
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters. Everyone is pretty fresh this morning. And even though the topic is maybe not that attractive, time of trouble such as never was, we will try not to deal with this strictly as if people had never heard this before, and just concentrate on that. If you still have your notes with you, I can tell you where we're going to try to travel this morning. We're going to work primarily on page 11, 12, 13, and I'd like to finish on page 15. Now, we had Revelation chapter 16 read this morning because it's one of those chapters, as we referred to many times yesterday, that tells us a detail which is not easy to get out of any other place in the Scriptures. Like, if we knew when the Lord was going to come for us, that would really help. We can see the sequence of things from the point of view of the nations. We have looked at the passage in Joel that talked about at the time when God brings again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem. That's the verse 1. And then verse 2, I'll gather all nations together and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. So we made quite a point of that, that having seen one thing, we should expect to see the next. And then drew attention to Revelation 16, that in the time of the sixth vial, that it tells us the things that would be happening in the earth to bring the nations together. As verse 14 is really quite illuminating in that. It says that they're the spirits of devils working miracles, going forth unto the kings of the earth to bring them together to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. Now, what is most instructive is that instead of this text then just going on to further describe that, it places a verse in between 14 and 16, which is talking, both of them are talking about the gathering, to say, I come as a thief. And it clearly implies that at some time during the preparation of gathering the nations together, that the Lord is going to come. And that the idea is not coming to the world as Zechariah 14, because that's really referred to in the seventh angel and the words, it is done, which is taken right from, I believe, Ezekiel 39, and clearly illustrates a pointing back to that chapter. So, as we mentioned yesterday in Joel chapter 3, he says, thither cause thy mighty ones to come down. In Zechariah 14, the saints will be with him. So, we have clear allusions in the Old Testament scriptures to the saints, that we believe the righteous ones coming from judgment, being with the Lord to carry out the judgments written. But we don't know exactly when he will come to judge us and take us away. Except the implication is that if you really wanted to look at things sequentially, you've got the Jews back in the land, the great sign, God preparing to gather all nations to Jerusalem for battle, but before the battle, Christ comes, and he comes to the household, and the idea being, blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked and he see his shame, and the concept of that is judgment. Now that's where you sort of turn the corner from just looking at these things as facts and information to exhortation, from exposition to exhortation. We must live on the edge of this event. I don't believe, point to a day like August 29th and say that's the day he's going to come. But at the same time, it must be very close. Now, I can remember my granddad saying that. And you might remember your granddad saying that too. I can remember my dad saying that. And dad, you know, out in the farm in our earlier days in the farm, he said, look, there's no use planting trees, because he wanted to plant some trees in the farm. He says, they'll never be big enough. The Lord will come back soon. Well, if we had planted trees, they'd be plenty big by now at that time. Now, they may have been wrong in their assessment, but they weren't wrong in the spirit they were saying it in, because that is the spirit that you get out of those words. When you see these events, then be prepared for this other event, which he says, "Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth." So we've been watching, and we've been looking intently at the events in the world to see just how much closer we are to the events, like as it mentions in verse 17, leading to the conclusion, "It is done." And everyone's just sort of pumps you up a little more. But it is possible that people going through that routine of rising in their expectations and then coming down and rising, is you get a little bit numb and you don't react anymore at all. So it comes back to this topic in many conversations between Christadelphians as to whether we will experience a time of trouble. Like, are we going to be ourselves involved in a time of trouble such as never was? And I think the Lord directing our attention to two time periods in history is helpful, the time period of Noah and the time period of Lot. Just for a second, looking at Luke 17. I mean, I'm sure we're well familiar with this, but there's a couple little things, little details in there, which will help put an exhortation impression upon these words. You can look at this from two quite different viewpoints. I think normally when we look at the flood and the judgments that came to pass at that time, we look at it from the mentality of Noah. And that's probably right, and is probably quite logical. Who would want to look at this from any other point of view? So Noah is conscious of the wickedness all around him. Noah is conscious of God's word, judgments coming. And Noah, out of respect for God's word, is busy preparing the ark. But try for a moment to put your mind in the set of a person who does not believe this. He's the average person out there. And for him, life is going on as it always was. And that's what Jesus picks up in Luke 17. He says, verse 27, "They did eat, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all." If you look at it from Noah's mindset, he was well aware, he was busy working, preparing himself for the day of destruction, but the other people, it was just life as normal. Now we look back on it and we see the things that God said about that life in the early books of Genesis, and we say, well, it was characteristic, the characteristic of it was violence. But it probably wasn't unusual or extraordinary to the people. The average person, it was every day. So there were murders. Yeah, there's murders every day. And you know that's exactly the way we live today. We almost are really unable to see that life is in troublous times or difficult because we're so surrounded by it. It's hard for us to be objective. We're too subjective. Unless, of course, we have Noah's mindset. The same thing occurs with Lot. We know what Lot thought about it because Peter tells us his righteous soul was vexed from day to day. We would never know that except from Peter's comment. But from the people in Sodom, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. Life was just, that was just what happened in life. That was everyday life for them until, of course, the day came that God's judgments came upon that city. So if we don't have the mindset of Noah, or if we don't have the mindset of Lot, we might just guess we could be quite fooled about how bad the times are. If you can reach back and try to view things from somebody else's point of view who doesn't know, like imagine yourself as Abraham suddenly being impressed with society today. Never seen anything like cars or telephones or any of these things. Then you can maybe get a little better view of just saying, well, I'm Abraham, and I don't know any of this, and now I'm suddenly trying to make some sense out of life. What would you think of it? Would you think it was godly, or would you think it was just perverted? Well, sometimes we need to step back, because if we're expecting a time of trouble, and times change gradually, we might still be expecting some time of trouble to come and not recognize we're in deep trouble. Very deep trouble right now. So what is this trouble? What's its characteristics? Well, this is where I've directed you on page 11 to just have a look at the thoughts given to us in Daniel chapter 12. There is the obvious parts of the time of trouble because of the political and the military events that are going on in the world that are described in Daniel 11 verses 40 through 45, and then immediately into Daniel 12. At that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the children of thy people. There shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. Many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Now, as we know from the scriptures and the pattern that God has set for us in the scriptures, there's many, many cases where there is a, sort of a literal interpretation of it, where you can see that this would have occurred literally. And then there's another side, a figurative side or a spiritual side that we have to consider as well. And so people have looked at this and said, well, a knowledge that shall be increased would probably be when the seals are removed from the book. It may very well refer to the time of the Lord Jesus Christ being the Lamb that was able to open the seals thereof, and further information was given. And even look down to the time when our pioneers were writing and coming out of darkness were able to actually reestablish the truth again. You can't dispute that. You look at the dark ages and the time when people just didn't have the truth. I suppose God always had a remnant, but certainly it wasn't as available as it is today. You can see that semblance there. But there has to be another aspect to this, and I think somewhat related to the time of trouble, which is characterized by two things: people running to and fro, and knowledge being increased. I mean, if a person wanted to describe our age, it would probably couldn't be better described. If you're going to try to look at two things, which characterizes the difference between people living in this century and people that have lived in any other century since men and women have been on the earth, they are very good descriptions of how we differ. Look at the travel that goes on today. This couldn't have gone on a century earlier because there was no means to travel like that. And how the world has changed because of that. And then, of course, that's not entirely independent of the knowledge being increased, because it was only with the knowledge being increased that that was able to take place. Now, I think that we are too subjective. This is life for us, and it's so much life for our children that they can't imagine it ever being any different when there weren't always cars, there weren't always airplanes, there weren't always telephones, weren't always computers. But there'd be brethren and sisters old enough to know when there weren't. I mean, some people living today have been able to span this tremendous period of change. And I don't know that anything can challenge your faith as so much change going on all the time. So that you have a hard time communicating with the younger people because they just think different. They're born into different things, they're raised in a different way, and it's hard to communicate the values of the truth to them. And I think that's created quite a challenge to us in our community to try to deal with that and still have the truth being passed from generation to generation. So in the notes on page 11, I wanted to draw attention to chapter 12, verse 4. And without elaborating it too much, I just say that I believe that there'd be some brethren here, maybe some sisters as well, who know that very personally from their work, where the pace at work has got to the point where people see now you really have to consider quitting. Because if you want to maintain any spiritual life, if you really want to maintain some energy and have some energy for spiritual life, you're just going to have to take it from work, because they're taking everything. And they're demanding everything, and almost telling you that if you don't give everything, then they'll get someone else who will. That's a tremendous pressure. Because for Christadelphians, who integrity of heart is very, very high on the list, it's hard to come and exercise yourself week by week through the emblems, knowing that you can eat and drink condemnation to yourself by not discerning the Lord's body, by not really thinking what you're supposed to be doing here and how it's supposed to be altering your life. And you find that condemnation, like it's, I don't have any energy left for the truth. I don't have any time left for the truth because my job takes everything. I don't even time to really properly raise the kids. And you just sort of feel trapped. Can't, in your own mind, think of quitting. Can't think of an alternative. And I just think there is a lot of Christadelphians in that position. And I just say that on the basis of people who just come and talk to me about it. And I know it because I've been through it. And then my choice, I just decided to quit, get out of it. And I must say that didn't necessarily open a whole lot of other doors and opportunities, but at least I got rid of one problem. Just got a few others, that's all. Let's continue before we sort of get much further in that. So in Luke 17, I'll just read from the notes on page 11, because this is very common knowledge to Christadelphians. We review this often. The challenge is to see the aspects of our society that must have been like Noah's day, because the Lord says, as it was in Noah's day, so shall it be in the day of the Son of Man. So there's got to be that aspect to it. And I just said that our age is unique in some ways. And still, going on to Lot, it was unique in ways from Lot's point of view as well, mainly from the media. Now, we go over to page 12 on the other side. And again, moving fairly quickly through this, Brother Thomas has written this up well in terms of what the sixth vial meant and the drying up of the Ottoman Empire, the significance in the establishment of the Jewish state, and in the frog-like spirits and identifying them with the French and the French Revolution, and illustrating that the dragon is represented in Russia, the beast in Europe, and the false prophet in the Vatican, and you know, not living any longer than he did, has left it for us to follow that through. Because if he's right in his interpretation, then those same spirits have to have continued to work, because their job was to gather the nations together to that great day of God Almighty, that great day of Armageddon. But there hasn't been much written on that, to my mind. I mean, it's something that if you look through Christadelphian writings since John Thomas, try to find people have taken that up and said, okay, now I want to show you how that the spirit-like demons, or the demon-like spirits, whichever way you want to see it, the madness is what I look at. I just say the philosophies of men which represent madness. That's how I think through those words of demons and spirits. Philosophies of men which are mad. They're just not common sense, but yet people are rushing at it. How has it worked? What's come out of Russia? What's come out of Europe? What's come out of the Vatican that you could categorize that way? Now, there is a book that I have referred to from time to time, and I brought a few of them with me, because the author is Acadian. His name is Ian Taylor. He's not a Christadelphian, but he wrote the book In the Minds of Men. And I never found any writing since the writings of John Thomas which have been more along his lines of reasoning, that today the philosophies which sort of govern the way this whole age operates is just mad. And I don't think this man ever intended to develop Revelation 16. I don't believe he ever refers to it. His writings are not to religious people in that sense. His writings are to everybody. They're quite general. He hasn't pegged a group of people. But his writings really help understanding how these ideas of men are leading to the great day of the Battle of Armageddon, because they're going down the route of Noah, they're going down the route of Lot, and they certainly are not going down the route of our Heavenly Father. An interesting little story about this man. I had a talk with him personally, and I'll tell you how it came about. I've always tried to encourage my children in school to not sit back and just, you know, be passive in a biology class where the teacher's telling you that we all came by the root of evolution, you know. If you can't do any harm at all by just asking questions. At least you can ask a question, but some of your questions can be quite pointed. In other words, the question really shows what you're driving at. And just see what you get for an answer. Because if what these teachers say is true, then what do they have for answers to the questions which, you know, the area is thin? And in the probing, because in the school in Shelburne, there's always been at least half a dozen Christadelphian children in that school. And the teachers, who don't change that often, know Christadelphians very well. Oh no, here we go again, you know, and they go through it all again. Because every one of the kids who's come through there has, in biology class, has just not been prepared to accept the ideas of evolution which are being governed. So this teacher, getting a little fed up with this, decided that what he'd do is he would invite one of the prominent speakers on evolutionists, who was a scientist. Now, he couldn't legally do this in class time, but he could legally do it by inviting this person to come to the school after hours and just put a little general notice around the school. Anyone wanting to come could listen to him and mention a few things in class too, with the idea that, hey, we're going to answer this. You guys don't think I have the knowledge and the ability to do this. Well, come and hear someone who is a scientist. So the chap came, and there was a few of the Christadelphian young people that came and listened to him. And, when your authority is me, like I know because I'm a scientist, it's pretty thin. Almost in any area today, if a person goes that route to try to establish authority, that's pretty thin. But anyway, my daughter came back to me, and she said, well, how do you deal with that? Because really what this teacher is saying is all we have to do is get someone's authority, and then that's the end of it. You just listen to him. And if he says it's evolution, it's evolution. So we thought, well, maybe there's a chance that we could get Ian Taylor, who is the author of that book, The Minds of Men, because he lives in Toronto, to come up and talk to the people at school as well. So I thought, well, we can't lose anything. We'll write him a letter. So I wrote him a letter, and he wrote back to say, yeah, he would come, but he didn't drive, as long as we pick him up. So, well, that's great, because I'll get a chance to talk to him. So we down and got him, took him up, and Ian Taylor's not the greatest of the speakers. He has, when it comes to talking to a group of young people, sometimes you can not really impress anybody because you just didn't get to the level right, way above them. You couldn't understand it. Anyway, we went through the same route, and he came to the class. They announced it around the school, and he made his presentation. I don't think anybody was really overly impressed one way or the other by what he had to say. But since he didn't have any transportation, I invited him back to the house for dinner. So we had a little chance to talk to him, and I thought all the kids, here's a person now that wrote that book. Here's a person who thinks like us, but he's not a Christadelphian. I think it's so important for young people to understand that we are... We're not isolated in our beliefs on creation and on how God formed things and started things off. There are other people who, in terms of scientists, Ian Taylor is just as qualified as a scientist as any of these other people. Scientists are not united on this. And sometimes that tells a bigger story than anything else. It certainly did around the high school, because the intent of bringing the chap in, well, here's a scientist, was really undone, well, here's another scientist who doesn't believe it. So you can see that the young people were getting the view then that, yeah, people disagree on this subject to the very top. So you have to make up your own mind. Anyway, we got a chance to give them Christendom astray and talk to them all the way home about the truth. And I have no idea. I've never talked to the man since. But I do believe it's important to take advantage if you can find out works like that are pretty quality works. And I think he is, that's a fairly good writing. And it certainly helps in these areas of what is the content of the things that are bringing the nations together, the spirits that are like madness out there. And of course, he works primarily on the spirit of humanism. All through the ages, in the last century at least, of how that humanistic spirit, godless spirit, explain things without the church, without God, is pervading society. And I'm going to comment a little bit on that and just developing page 13. But let's finish off page 12 first. Now, there's another thing that has impressed me, brothers and sisters, about this whole thing. Is God is very merciful in this. Like, why wouldn't he just intervene? And you go back and you think, when Abraham was wandering in the land, there's statements, you just sort of way out of place. The iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Why is that there? I mean, what would there be any reason of saying that in the text? Doesn't add anything to anything above it, below it, just the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet full. Because God was not prepared to give them the land until it was full. And then he says the reason they got the land wasn't because of the righteousness of the Israelis, but because of the wickedness of the inhabitants. And speaks of the land as the land vomited them out because they were so wicked, and spells out all the wickedness associated with it. So God, in his mind towards society, will reach a time when their wickedness is full, and he will intervene. And we can see, it would seem, that there seems to be little spikes or little peaks in people's wickedness where God does intervene. And I just pointed out one here. If you just turn to Jeremiah chapter 51, just to illustrate this, I found this really strengthening in my faith. Jeremiah 51, verse 26 says, of Babylon. And we know where that sits in history, and we know that there was a city site. We know that the Hanging Gardens are one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It was a magnificent city, the big Ishtar gates that Daniel had to go through. It was set up to display the honor and glory to man. And God's words were, they will not take of thee a stone for a corner, nor a stone for foundations, but thou shalt be desolate forever, saith Yahweh. That's what he said about Babylon. And then, in our day, just a few years ago, the news media tells us that Saddam Hussein is going to rebuild Babylon, and he's working on it. And his idea is it's going to be a big tourist attraction. People are going to come to Babylon, and they're going to see it in its ancient glory, because he's trying to reestablish the Ishtar gates, and is trying to, just what everyone else is. If you got something that you can get people to come to, and the tourism is going to bring a lot of money into your country, it's a good idea to work it out. But he got shut down in the process. Because it seems to me that what was at stake here was a prophecy that said it would be desolate forever. He did not see any future for that city. That city was to be destroyed and gone. And I just still marvel at the way that happened. Where instead of blowing it to smithereens, God just stopped its development by shutting off the economic sort of route that he was using to develop it and have the money to develop it. And I think that's the way God's working in all areas. One of the other things that I think is worth looking at, and I just noticed the brother was commenting to me about this himself, was his observation. But in Genesis 11, after the flood, in verse 1, it says, the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And we know that the story goes on as we, tell it in Sunday school, and I've heard it in Sunday school, that they decided they'd build a tower, verse 4, whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Now, God's assessment here is really worth listening to. It says, and Yahweh came down to see the city, and the tower which the children of men builded. And Yahweh said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Go down. Let us go down and confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. And Yahweh scattered them abroad upon the face, or thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. God saw that if you allow people to work just with their imagination, they will end up in ways which will frustrate his purpose. And he's not going to allow his purpose with mankind to be frustrated. Like people think, well, there could be nuclear war to destroy the earth. But God's purpose with the earth was to be inhabited. That's what we're told in Isaiah 45. He created the earth to be inhabited. But God's not going to be frustrated in that, so you need not be concerned that the world's going to be destroyed by men and their devices, because God will not allow it. His purpose will not be frustrated. When he sees it's likely to be frustrated, he does something. He intervenes. So he changed their language, and he stopped them. But in our day, language is no longer a barrier. And people talk to each other and communicate to each other all over the world. And one of the greatest testimonies to this is this space lab that the Russians have, which the Americans and people from Europe and that have gone up, and they work together in that lab, different languages, different cultures, but it's not a problem today. So in today's age, we start again to see things people are imagining to do,
And it isn't interesting that it's in the news just the last little bit about this whole idea of cloning. You get the idea of what people are imagining to do. And, you know, quite apart from where they've gone in cloning, I mean, so far, I mean, what's being published? Who knows what hasn't been published? But what's being published is they've done this with sheep. But people who have picked up the significance of this in news media have said, but look at what they can do. If you can take a cell like they did from an adult animal, and you can grow another animal which is identical, then maybe this is a way where a person could become immortal. Now, I don't think that is equivalent, but that's the way the news media picked it up, that you could just clone a new individual which would be identical to you. I don't know what that means. You'd think the same, or whether you'd... I don't have any idea about that. But it would seem to me to be almost general that people accept that is not right. People, even without a conscience towards the Bible or towards God, just see that's just not right. And they may change, because many cases, ideas introduced over time, people did change. It's like the whole idea that Hitler introduced when he rose to power, that he was going to produce a pure Aryan race. He never got that idea originally. That was someone else's idea, well documented in the minds of men, that other people had those ideas. He just rose to power and was able to put it in place. And then people say, what an awful guy he was for what he was trying to do with humans and trying to get rid of all the undesired individuals in society and just take the people that everyone liked and to make sure that they were the only ones that could breed and could have offspring and hence control the population. That's still being practiced in the world today. The idea of eugenicism, where you take a particular group of the population and you only allow that part to continue. So it's not far removed from cloning. And I just think that those things are the subject of verse 6. That God, like the iniquity of the Amorite, is not yet full, but it's getting fuller. And we'll get to the point where God will see that his purpose with mankind is now likely to be frustrated, and he will intervene. Now, we live in the middle of it, brothers and sisters. And as I said earlier, do you really think that we have the mindset always of Noah or Lot, or do we have the mindset of the people for which all these things are just normal life? That's just the age in which we live, and we don't see it as abruptly as God would see it. Now, page 13 is just a little attempt on my part to try to put together a uniqueness about our age. Now, you have to understand that's the attempt. It's the uniqueness. I'm trying to illustrate by this page of detail that there are things here which were not true of other ages. Like if you have a time of trouble such as never was, forget the time of trouble and just think about the phrase, such as never was. There's been many times of trouble. Many times of trouble. Even for Israel, there have been many times of trouble. But this time of trouble is one such as never was. There's a uniqueness about it. And what I'm trying to say is if you link that with Daniel chapter 12 about his emphasis on going to and fro and knowledge being increased, you can see how that there are things that have happened in society which now are, this is the effects of it. We'll look at them. Certainly nuclear weapons had no place prior to their invention, prior to their perfection, prior to their use. Since the age of nuclear weapons, it's a totally different world in what people have the capability of doing. Armies used to have to come out. They used to have great numbers of men, as the Lord himself picked up the analogy. You know, which man's going to go and fight against another nation when he's only got half the number of men? But today, if you have missiles, you don't have to have men in that sense. So there's a uniqueness about today. The idea of chemical weapons. And I don't know if I mentioned it in there somewhere, but the idea of biological weapons. And who knows how many other ways they've thought of destroying people. Like I believe that at one point they were developing a neutron bomb. The idea of a neutron bomb was that you just kill people, but you don't contaminate everything like, it would be contaminated with a normal nuclear weapon. It is high radiation that has a very short life, just kills everything. Then you can take the place over and you haven't destroyed it all. They were trying to perfect that, but I believe that was banned. I don't know for sure. I don't have my facts exactly right on that or straight, but I believe that. And when they saw the ability to develop that weapon, they banned it because they could see how easily it could be used, how much more desirable it was to be used than other nuclear weapons. That's the age we live in. It's an incredible age. The idea of plastic explosives and how you can sneak them through into areas where no one would suspect and people carry out their acts of terror. You know, the point, or maybe I should have put numbers on this, but the idea of handguns and the widespread availability of handguns that were, you know, the laws weren't enforced or there weren't any laws concerning how guns actually are stored. That from now on then we hear about children picking up guns and using them because they had no idea what they were capable of doing. I often wonder, now we babysit a little child, Dorothy and I, and it's just to let someone else have a little more freedom in their life. They, at the present time, they're pretty strapped, but this little child comes in, he's 3 years old, and he comes in, you know, with the posture of a gun, and he shoots everybody. 3 years old. Where'd this kid ever get this from? Well, I'm sure his dad and mom didn't teach him, but if they allow him to watch television, then he's seen it so many times. I mean, how would he know what it means to kill a person? They reappear again the next day, and there's nothing wrong with them. See, that's the thinness of the morals of society. If society was more moral, they would see how that corrupts, and they would. And they have taken certain care concerning that, but largely, when a three-year-old gets that idea and thinks it's great, come in and shoot everybody in the house, where did you ever get that idea from? Now, we are so used to it, we probably don't see how abhorrent that is to our God. We see things quite often through the eyes of the people of the days of Lot and the days of Noah. And we don't see it strictly through the idea or the mindset of Noah and of Lot. Even Lot's wife and his children couldn't see it his way. It's difficult to see things that way. The media. I think one of the interesting things about the media is that they have learned to be subtle. We used to look, it was a memorized thing, that he was doing it out of this is the prayer I give for this particular thing all the time. But it had come out of the heart, and in the heart were all kinds of things that the brother had, and he just used them as it was appropriate without possibly even knowing how he was going to do that. It just happened when he was praying. It becomes extremely revealing and helpful to hear brethren who can put it together for others is very, very valuable. But some prayers you hear, you wonder if the brother, you know, is with us in prayer. The prayers are so mechanical. The prayer for the wine is nothing much different than the opening prayer for the meeting. And the prayer the person would give for his meal is not much different than he would close in the ecclesia with. That everything is just, there's nothing personalized about it. Like there's been very little development in prayer. And it would seem to me now, and look, it takes everybody, you know, there's amount of time, and this is not something I've ever come by easy. It's only by reading these things and thinking about them and trying to imagine how those things could be connected that what you really see out of this is God's telling us, or the Lord's telling us, that if we are dependent upon our own strength, then we're not getting anything from prayer, and prayer's not meaningful to us, then we're going to faint. We are in a fainting stage. Just look at a couple points that I've mentioned here in the text on this. I won't turn up Hebrews 11, verse 6. You'll probably recall that, where it just says that those that come to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those that diligently seek Him. So prayer is really an act of faith. If people are not praying, if they don't find this a part of their life and a strong part of their life, it's a measure that they probably don't have faith. Because God says, you can't even come to me unless you believe that I am and that I am a rewarder of diligent service. So why would you pray to God? Well, He's the rewarder of diligent service. He's the one that we respect. He's the creator of all life. He lives. He is. He's the one who has a purpose, and it will be fulfilled. But not to recognize that in prayer is almost to suggest that there is no faith. And that's worrisome. It says in Habakkuk 2, verse 3 and 4, that the just will live by his faith. Paul makes a big point out of that when he's talking of that in comparison with people living by law. He's saying you might understand that it was the Old Testament in Habakkuk where we learned that the just lives by faith. But brothers and sisters, ask yourself, do you live by faith? I have to ask myself that. Like if we're living by faith, or do we largely live by things that people do in society? Like you just sit down, take a piece of paper, and just see how the average person survives in a godless way. Well, society has tried to cover all the corners. If you're fearful that when you are no longer have enough strength to go out and earn your living, then you better get a retirement fund set up so that when you retire, it'll take care of you. Was that ever set up by religious people? Did we get that from the Bible? Does the Bible tell us that we should have these registered retirement savings plans? Or is that just what men and women have come up with as to how to look after society in their older age? See, if we don't think about it, we default to what other people do. I'm not suggesting that's good or bad. I'm just saying that did not likely come from religious people. It came from people saying, what do you do when you can't look after yourself? Well, when you can look after yourself, you put away a little bit. And then you have enough in old age, it will look after you. Do we live by faith? Or do we look after ourselves? If we live by faith, then don't expect that you're going to know exactly how it works. But that's entirely how the world looks at it. They try to explain it to you in detail. You need these plans. Get in there, invest, and this is what it will be, and this is how much money you'll have. We don't live that way. Or do we live that way? I mean, our trust is in our God. As he says in Hebrews chapter 10, and this is one we want to look up, if we really live by faith, there has to be the evidence of it in our lifestyle. Verse 35, cast not away therefore your confidence, which hath great recompense of reward, for you have need of patience, that after you have done the will of God, you might receive the promise. For yet a little while, he that shall come, and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, but if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in them. But we are not of them who draw back into perdition, but on them that believe to the saving of the soul. So it's worth trying to make sure that we can see the differences between us, to make sure that faith is there, brothers and sisters, and that we're not just living by the default way of the world, that you just do things to look after yourself. Our strength is not in self. Maybe have a time for just a couple more references. We go back to Genesis 25. It's just, as one of those well-known things, but maybe we haven't seen it just in this light. I mean, the children learned this story. They acted out on stage. We've maybe memorized the lines ourselves at some times, but when it comes down to being exhorted by it, it's a very strong area of exhortation. Just a few verses in Genesis 25, verse 29. Jacob sawed pottage. Esau came from the field, and he was faint. See, you picked that up by taking the word faint and going through the scriptures. You can do that very easy with one of those computer programs or just an ordinary concordance, just to get the word faint in every place. Well, what happened when Esau was faint? Now, do you think Esau was going to die? No. He thought he was going to die. Have you ever had your children tell you that their motions were that if they don't have a meal now, they're going to die? You know, it's just something that's part of our nature that, boy, if we don't eat when we're ready to eat and we're hungry, it's something awful, awful is going to happen. And yet we read in the scriptures of people fasting incredible lengths of time. And I'm sure in some cases they were supported by God, but it wasn't unusual for people to miss meals. Now, how do you teach that to your children, that you won't die if you miss a meal? But if you had never taught it to your children, then it's quite likely they could fall into the same condemnation as Esau, because they got hungry. And when they were hungry, that feeling in their stomach was more important than anything else in their life. So Jacob, being the kind of man he was, said to him, "Sell me this day thy birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I am at the point to die." See, he thought he would die for that. Well, the record tells us he couldn't have been at that point. "What profit shall this birthright do to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me this day." And he swore unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink, rose up, went his way. Now, if he was at the point of dying, one meal wouldn't have made that difference. You can't get that kind of strength that quick from a meal. So he was not at the point of dying physically, but mentally he was. That's what happens when you're faint. You start listening to your body, to your feelings, to your mind, and saying, "I'm going to die." And at that point, you are so vulnerable that people are prepared to sell their birthright. Now, brothers and sisters, think it through. This was not written for anybody except the reader to be exhorted by. Can that happen in our life? Have we got to the point where feelings, things that really were not, they're not the key things in life, they aren't the real important things, but we've made major decisions possibly because of feelings, thinking that we're going to die. We didn't act out of faith. We acted out of the fact that we were faint. That's very instructive. And of course, the other case is in Judges. No, that's not the one. Where have I got it here? Deuteronomy 29. Maybe we remember this one even more than the case of Esau. And that was the case of Amalek. And although this is not the prime passage to deal with Amalek, it's the one that we get the interpretation. In Deuteronomy 25, verse 17, we read, "Remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way when you are come forth out of Egypt, how he met thee by the way and smote the hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee, when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not God." Now, we're not interested at the moment in the rest of that, but just this, that at the time that Amalek came against Israel, he found that there were a lot of stragglers. Instead of Israel being together in a knit group, there were people that were straggling behind. What were they characterized by? They were faint and weary. Now, he's not talking about people being faint and weary as if, hey, don't ever allow your strength to get that low. Take a chocolate bar with you. Keep your strength. He's not talking about that at all. He's talking about spiritual strength. And you and I know, brothers and sisters, what that means. When you are straggling in the truth, you're bringing up the rear, you're just not keeping up. When you really have the options to keep up, but you're the straggler, you are vulnerable. You're vulnerable to Amalek. And Amalek is the kind of a person who just takes advantage of that situation. And, you can expand that out into all kinds of things in life where you are more susceptible to failure because you're spiritually weak. God's telling us that's the things that we have to be aware of. So when people come to a study day, at least you would think, we recognize the fact that we need the strength to keep up. Not the physical strength that you get from a chocolate bar or something like that, but the strength we get from His Word, which we can't explain, but we know we get because we feel differently and we act differently out of that feeling. Those are the things where, when people don't do that, you might guess, you might understand that it being stragglers, they're at risk. And you worry about them. You see your children, you see people that are close to you, you've worked on and helped, people that have been converted to the faith, not attending, not keeping up. You might guess they could be victims of Amalek, because that's exactly what happens. He looks for stragglers, for people that are not keeping up. And just to bounce that off with what we find to provide strength, as is recognized so well by the Apostle Paul through 2 Corinthians. Let's look at a quotation there from chapter 12. I just think this got to be one of the most helpful passages in the Bible for people who may, through their circumstances, feel quite bitter. That, why has this happened to me? Out of all the people who have their health and the strength, why should I be the one to come down to be sick or be infirm? of all the people who could serve the Lord in the ways I wanted to, why am I the person who can't because of what's happened to me in life? And that's exactly what the Apostle Paul says. He could well imagine how he could serve the Lord to a much greater capacity in his own mind, but God had given him this sickness or whatever it was to afflict him. And he prays to God. Let's just read the context there. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 7. Lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given unto me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord thrice, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong. Now, there's no person out there without that background ever speak that way. That nobody naturally is going to say that when you're weak, you're strong. They're going to say when you're weak, get some medicine, go to a doctor. That's what they would say. But the Apostle Paul could see a way that when infirmities befell him, when things that you could be bitter over took place in his life, it was a time to feel strong, not to feel weak. That was through a mental process based on his understanding of the gospel message. And it's written for our learning. I think that's incredible. Every now and then you find a person. I've found several people in my life who I just been wonderful examples of this, who sickness have put them on a bed. They couldn't go out preaching to people. They couldn't really do any of the works that normal people would do in life. But when you talk to them, you found them just a wealth of understanding, of encouragement. You go over there to visit them, to help them. You come home feeling strengthened because you've had a few minutes with them. Say, how do people do that? Why wouldn't you be really bitter that, you know, life circumstances, or as more properly you'd say, that God's choice was that you weren't the person who had the health and the strength and the opportunity to go out and do things as you would have liked to have done? Because in any way, any capacity at all, God's seen there are ways that we can work in his service. If you have that mindset, if our strength is not us, and it's not even what we would necessarily like to do, but we've got our strength from our God. We get strength from prayer. We have faith. We manifest faith in life. These are the things that must be very important to us, brothers and sisters, in this particular unique time of trouble, which may grow, but I think everyone has to appreciate we're in. The truth may be strong in some areas, but it is obviously not strong in other areas. And in some places, we see it uniquely going in new avenues and doing things like the seminars is relatively new, and it's interesting and it's helpful. But you probably know as many as I know of areas where it's weak and where we expected the truth to grow, didn't even get to the flower stage. It's gone. So with that, we just sort of rest our case about, behold, I come as a thief. Those people who know the exhortation will be watching, be looking at all these things and trying to make sure that they have the faith and trust in their God to get them through these days.